Kviečiame klausytis Kauno menininkų namų skaityklos renginių ciklo Nemigos salonas renginio įrašo. Šį renginį Liepos 28 dieną organizavo kartu Absoliutaus laisvalaikio darbininkų klubas, kurį įkūrė nomadiška projektų erdvė kabinetas ir politinė erdvė Luna 6. Šis renginys tai skaitimų sesija, kuri koncentravosi į britų autoriaus Marko Fišerio tekstą Baroque Sunburst, kuris pažiūrė įdomių minčių apie reivą kaip apie šventišką užkratą, skatinantį plisti naujas kolektyvinio sambūvio formas į nepakenčiamai susvetimėjusią komercijos išvalytą miesto erdvę. Renginį moderavo Agnė Bagdžiūnaitė, Noa Bremer ir Vaida Stepanovaitė. Rekomenduojame klausant renginio įrašo taip pat skaityti ir Marko Fišerio tekstą tuo pačiu metu. Renginys vyko anglų kalba. Gero jums klausimo.
Taigi, dar kartą sveiki atvykę į Nemigos saloną ir skaitimus apie reivą. Tai dabar aš duosiu žodį pristatyti būtent šitam Ultimate Leisure Workers Club pagrindiniams organizatoriams, nežinau, Vaida, tu pradėsi. Dar kartą įspėjai, bus viskas anglų kalba.
So I'm just starting to talk in English now. So hi, everyone. So welcome to Ultimate Leisure Workers Club and Insomnia Salon. So we have this initiative that's been just released this year, and it's actually our first public event, so it's very nice to see people coming over. So this club is an initiative by Project Space Cabinetas, which is also led by... I saw Ruta somewhere. by Ruta Stepanovaita and me. Here's Ruta. I'm just seeing you're part of Cabinetas as well. And it's a political, cultural political hub, Luna 6, which is in Vilnius, and Noa is kind of representative of that. So we established this club as kind of to rethink like politics and economies of today through the trope of nightlife and nightclub. So that's what we will be doing today. Basically, I don't know if you want to interfere somewhere, just see something else you can.
Sure. Yeah, and the club kind of plays the line between popular notions of a club as a nightclub and the club as a social club. And, as it goes on, I think we'll actively kind of work between both spaces of maybe doing some parties sometimes and something like this at others. Currently, the club has kind of taken two different the form of two different groupings. So this grouping is called the Leisure Communism Group, and the other group is called the Action Group. The Action Group is more about practices, artistic and political, dealing with nightlife politics, and the Leisure Communism Group is a theoretical-oriented group. And I guess I can say just a sentence or two about leisure communism, as of course it's kind of like a weighty word. So when we develop, what we think about when we talk about leisure communism is the idea of a society without work and without a state. It in some ways goes back to pre-capitalist ideas of communism, but also it goes into very futurist ideas of tech, the kind of way that technology can eliminate meaningless work and like open up lots of time and free time for creativity.
Yeah, we're kind of running now this leisure communism group, as Noah said, like in a theoretical way. So we're kind of trying to define what leisure communism is, and we try to define it collectively. So like we already had one reading, which we read Kristen. A book by Kristen Ross, which was called Communal Luxury. So we kind of tried to get into the notion of the communal through there. So today we're trying to focus on nightlife and kind of the leisure part. So I don't know what the third will be, but we will see. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and then the other points of why we connect leisure communism with the idea of a kind of a ultimate leisure workers club is that we see the nightlife as a time outside of work, and this time mobilized by popular desires to leave behind the world of work. So the exercise is to kind of play with this imaginary, these fantasies of worlds without work, and to develop them into a kind of broader political relations beyond just the nights, but as part of our like, everyday.
Yeah, and just a little bit, maybe before we just dive into reading, which we came for, just like to say a bit of like maybe plans for the like Ultimate Leisure Workers Club. So we're kind of doing like series of events in preparation for what will happen in November. So this year in November, we have like the main public series of events. We'll have a rave, we'll have discussions and all of that that we're developing throughout the year with people whom we invited to join. So it's like very much we're trying to establish this kind of collective way of thinking about what can be done or like how can it be done. And we're just kind of, that's why like we're trying to establish this club as a club, you know, that's why like it's not a club that's a project, but it's a club. So so let's see.
And then I don't know, to introduce the text.
Yeah, maybe let's introduce how it's going to happen, the structure of it. I think that we're going to read it out loud, every paragraph. And if you want to read it, please raise your hand.
Join in.
I think we can switch readers, like, around, each person can read a paragraph, maybe two.
Whenever
you get tired.
Yeah, so basically we'll be reading through the whole text. It's not a very long text, but it'd be nice just to, you know, to read it through, because not everyone has read it before coming here, and also just a nice practice. And what we'll do is kind of read in sections, and then after each section we'll just stop and then rewind, and then kind of go back to some points that you want to raise or we want to raise, and like we want to hear what you think about them as well. And maybe a bit about Fisher. I don't know what to
Or maybe, I don't know, somebody else can also say something.
Also someone else also can please join.
Fisher's it's a very like popular writer, a kind of a left cultural theorist from the UK. He had this popular blog called K-Punk, where it was a mixture of like a music review, sci-fi, like analysis, like interpretation of sci-fi films, and it's like a very mixed genre. He studied, he was part of this kind of famous philosophy program in Warwick in the 90s called the Cybernetic. Wait, CCRU. What is it?
Cybernetic Cultural Research Unit.
Thank you.
I think.
Unit.
Okay. Unit, yeah.
He
wrote Capitalist Realism.
Right.
Which is like his most like popular.
It's basically about how he believed late capitalism closed down the imagination of any kind of possibility of thinking a world beyond it. And this happened on a cultural level, where like a culture just has come to repeat itself and like endlessly draw back from the past. We can debate that, but
And he very much supported he wanted to open up the imagination through, like, for example, even he considered gathering at popular cafes as like, you know, kind of occupation of a public space, basically. Like, of this commercial space, like, turning into public space. So for him it was very important, and he supported all kinds of self-organized groups and in all over England as well. And he was giving talks for free, and like,
I also thought it could be, like, very nice very nice read for us today when we're thinking about leisure communism, and to read Fischer's Baroque Sunburst, which he wrote in this book, Rafe and its Influence on Art and Culture. So I guess we can just kind of dive in and see what happens.
Oh yeah, and if you don't have the text, it is online. If you want to read by your phone,
yeah,
it's possible.
Yeah. Online, if you go to maybe Facebook event, if you saw it there.
Yeah, there's a link.
There's a link, and then in that link, there you will see like a hyperlink which you press, and then PDF will come up. So like, just let us know if you have.
And it's also good when we're reading, like if there's words or terms you're not familiar with, like feel very free to stop us and like, yes.
Because we actually had to do that ourselves as well, just kind of Google or figure out what that is or just discuss and see. So like, just feel free to do that.
And if you're familiar with the Greek written context and history more, let us know.
Yeah.
Okay.
In the late 80s and 90s, the psychic privatization, which is now such a striking feature of contemporary British life, entered a new phase. The miners' strike in the 80s had seen the defeat of one form of collective life. The privatization of nationalized industries, the selling off of council houses, and the proliferation of consumer electronics and new entertainment platforms, such as satellite TV, then in its early days, prepared the way for a retreat from and denigration of the public world. As the home became more connected, the space outside started to be abandoned, pathologized, and enclosed. It is in this context that we must see the Tory government's attack on rave in the 90s. The infamous Criminal Justice and Public Order Act of 1994 targeted squatting, hunt saboteuring, and unauthorized camping as well as rave. At the time, the act looked arbitrary, draconian, and absurd. The regulation of partying under legislation that relied on the ludicrously vague term repetitive beats seemed like overreaching. Yet, the act showed once more that authoritarianism has always been the supplement of neoliberalism's official emphasis on individual liberty. The founding event of neoliberalism was the savage crushing of Allende's Democratic Socialist Administration in Chile. Throughout the 80s, the Thatcher government had deployed authoritarian measures against the urban black population and against the organized working class. But why no pick on ravers, who might be disturbing rural peace, but weren't for the most part engaged in systematic dissent or rebellion? The campaign against rave might have been draconian, but it was not absurd or arbitrary. Very much to the contrary, the attack on rave was part of a systematic process, a process that had begun with the birth of capitalism itself. The aims of this process were essentially threefold: cultural exorcism, commercial purification, and mandatory individualism. So the whole thing now.
Okay.
Kind of an introduction.
Yeah, it's like introductory part.
But I guess... Well, I can just say like some simple fact stuff. So if someone doesn't know, the miners' strike that he refers to in the second sentence, became the symbol of the defeat of what was called organized labor or the labor movements of the 20th century, because there was a massive strike against the closure of a mine by the miners' union in the UK, and Thatcher's government defeated it. And with this victory, she kind of declared the beginning of a new era of the organization of social space.
But does it mean denigration? It's like degradation, but more nice? Like denigration
where is it?
Of the public world.
In which
prepare the way for a retreat from and denigration.
Yeah, kind of a moral, I think,
moral
degradation.
Mm.
Does anyone want to read
the part on cultural exorcism?
The whole of it?
This
no,
guy.
No, this
I
is
mean,
the
one.
Yeah, we just can just come jump in. I guess we can read less than I've read. like
yeah,
paragraph,
section,
couple,
yeah.
Okay, cultural exorcism. The exorcism was directed against what Herbert Marcuse called the specter of a world which could be free. A specter that music culture, especially in its collective and ecstatic modes, has always called up. The historic mission of the British bourgeoisie was the total elimination of the specter, something it was as close to achieving by the beginning of the 21st century as any culture has ever been. Rave's association with the English countryside made it especially problematic. As Michael Perelman shows in The Invention of Capitalism, the rise of capitalism would never have been possible without the enclosure of the countryside. Although their standard of living may not have been particularly lavish, the people of pre-capitalistic Northern Europe, like most traditional people, enjoyed a great deal of free time. The common people maintained innumerable public holidays that punctuated the tempo of work. At least one-third of the year was devoted to leisure. For capitalism to become dominant, this leisure culture, and the set of expectations and habits that went with it, had to be eliminated. This entailed the brutal destruction of the peasantry's capacity for self-provisioning. In addition to violent dispossession, the bourgeoisie propagated a dismal cult of work, which extolled the virtue of hard work while condemning any use of time not devoted to capital accumulation as profligate and morally degenerate. Rave's ecstatic fest... Stop.
Yeah. So, for me, the question is, the historic mission of the British bourgeoisie was the total elimination of the specter, something it was as close to achieving by the beginning of the 21st century as any culture has ever been. So for me, the question is, why exactly this moment, when he's saying about the statures, beginning, and then now he turns in that it's actually 2000s when the culture, this whole most are destroyed almost completely.
Because it took about 20-30 years, I would guess that's his take on it.
But
that
for,
it's
for
not
what?
you do not destroy culture, just with the one sword or one pen signature or whatever, but that it takes time and all these things that he says before and he will say later. What are these techniques of governance and what are this kind of submission of population to a certain kind of time management and certain demands and that it's nearing its completion that it never had up till now.
Yeah, but what does it entail exactly, like concrete things, like privatization of the public sphere?
But I think this is also about a certain individual and collective sort of openings of autonomy or whatever, feelings of liberation, all these kinds of escapes, this world that could be free, the specter of something that was since the medieval or whatever, since forever, there was something there in all this British popular culture that was always alive as practices, as folklore, as whatever, as, having space, that there was this, the enclosure starting with the kind of agriculture, that now not only there is no space, but there is also the psychic space that was foreclosed.
So
this is how he starts with the psychic privatization, and I think this is what he means, that by now, since 80s and 90s, now it's almost complete.
And there's, we kind of, when we were reading through, we bookmarked these points on this idea of this closure and this war against the peasantry. And this kind of refers to what's now this very popular idea of the commons. And this is the idea and practice in a pre-capitalist age, and particular, well, usually the reference is England, but it happens in many other societies as well, also non-European societies. But it's basically, in the most simple way, that commons was people could freely collect resources from the forest. Like, nobody owns the forest, so there is a common culture built around a common resource. And this allowed for a certain kind of freedom and a particular kind of sociality and independence from the rulers that was taken away as one of the most significant acts in the beginning of capitalism. And that was the privatization, the closure of common resources, which ran from forests but also to land. For growing crops and this kind of thing. So,
I would just add, maybe also for popular reference, that one of the ways that these commons are being brought to kind of political significance now, not only that there are various kind of political initiatives and so on, but also very often, and one of the more popular expressions is also talking about digital commons, for example, mm-hmm. and all these things that, for example, digitally was seen as something common since the 90s, as such a Wikipedia or, you know, open source platforms, or open software, or all these kinds of things that were supposed to bring something common, could be used by anyone, and cannot be privatized, cannot be enclosed. Which, of course, when you dig into it, has its own problems and issues and so on, but I think that's one of the ways to bring back these notions.
I just think that, Agnes, you have had this kind of thoughts about people, like pre-capitalists, people in pre-capitalist Northern Europe having a great deal of free time. And it's very...
I think of it as more like a bit ahistorical in a way that it doesn't kind of consider how people lived at that time. It's like you feel it's a bit of romanticizing, but like at the same time, you will see another paragraph that he kind of comes back to it and say what he means. But this pre-capitalist peasantry. Yes, they had this self-provisioning more in terms of, like, autonomy and how they deal with their work and with their day, but at the same time, it's a lot of, reproduction work, like, this to survive, to basically, like, heat up, especially Northern Europe, and you have to heat up the place.
But I think he's talking about that
cook.
Because he's talking about private land ownership specifically.
Which is
one of the vectors that allowed capitalism to like essentially spread, because like land was no longer held like in the public trust,
mm-hmm.
right? Like now land is privatized. So once you have privatized land, suddenly the people that used to work the land are working for someone else. It's a displaced room.
But still there's this question of the more free time in the peasant era, which is, But it's, anyways, if it's not purely factual, perhaps it's, mythologically quite nice.
And I think the way we understand free time now is totally different, because it's like work and free time.
Right.
I think there also might be a point of the way the author understands peasantry, and it doesn't seem to be very close to reality.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
At least one third of the year was devoted to leisure. I mean, are you sure? Like, do you know where potatoes come from?
Okay, so let's continue. Mm-hmm. The Raves Ecstatic, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Raves Ecstatic festivals received a use of time and land which the bourgeoisie had forbidden and sought to bury. Yet, for all that it recalled those older festive rhythms, rave was evidently not some archaic revival. It was a specter of post-capitalism more than a pre-capitalism. Rave culture grew out of the synthesis of new drugs, technology, and music culture. MDMA and AK-based Akai, based electronic psychedelia, generated a consciousness which saw no reason to accept that boring work was inevitable. The same technology that facilitated the waste and futility of capitalist domination could be used to eliminate drudgery, to give people a standard of living much greater than that of pre-capitalist peasantry, while freeing up even more time for leisure than those peasants could enjoy. As such, rave culture was in tune with those unconscious drives which, as Marcuse put it, could not accept the temporal dismemberment of pleasure, its distribution in small separate doses. Why should rave ever end? Why should there be any miserable Monday mornings for anyone? If you're a good person, you work like whatever, your 8-hour, 12-hour shift, and then after you work, there's an allotment of time of whatever, 4 hours reserved for some kind of enjoyment or recovery practices, and then you go to sleep and then you start again. But rave kind of like collapses this distribution of the time in our days by like the raver kind of decides to extend into working time, you know, by still partying into the morning when like the reign of work has begun. So it's something like this. Mm-hmm.
We had this this tour for this rave or party places for Kaunas, and there was this one party, always like rave kind of party, as like defined as rave party, that was going on Sundays for 3 hours.
what part of Sunday?
It's that evening.
In the evening.
Yeah, and it was as kind of this, I would say that it's very much related to this Baroque sunburst, because for some people it was just a moment of total relaxation and, you know, kind of running, escaping away from this all, also Morozes, it's Horsi, yeah, Horsi at that time, and also for women to be more free, just to dance on their own, not to wait for men to be invited to dance and stuff like that. So it's like, yeah, it's like this glimpse of rave into in Kaunas was like, it started like very much at the beginning of 90s, so just a little.
Oh yeah, this point I really liked. Grabbed before the sentence, the same technology that facilitated the waste and futility of capitalist domination could be used to eliminate drudgery, to give people a standard of living much greater than that of pre-capitalist peasantry. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, what's drudgery?
Just like a boring, repetitive work.
Oh, yeah.
So like what I like about this, and maybe a nice thing to kind of focus on about it, is like the actual like soundscape in raves, like techno really was like a way, like in many ways like a repurposing of the machinery of capitalism for this kind of communal joy and collective life, and that's I just heard this, which is really nice. The New York techno scene happened, like really sprung into existence after the electricity blackouts in like 92, because people were looting the shops, and like in black neighborhoods there was suddenly appeared technology that they never would have been able to like have access to ever before, and this like literally kind of like was the thing that energized the wave of techno in New York. So
basically now people are hoping that because of the good things that happened in the USA, maybe we'll have a new revival of music or play or something. But this was the main point of like trying to make this historical connection.
Commercial purification. Raves also recalled the interstitial spaces between commerce and festival. That provoked anxiety among the early bourgeois. In the 17th and 18th century, as it struggled to impose its the bourgeois was very much exercised by the problematic status of the fair. It was the illegitimate contamination of pure commerce by carnival excess and collective festivity, which troubled bourgeois writers and ideologists. The problem which they faced, however, was that commercial activity was always already tainted with festive elements. There was no pure commerce, free from collective energy. Such a commercial sphere would have to be produced, and this involved the
subduing
and ideological incorporations of the marketplace, as much as it entailed the domestication of the fair. As Peter Stalybrice and Alan White pointed out in The Political and Poetics of Transgression, the fair, like the marketplace, is neither pure nor outside. The fair is at the crossroads situated in the intersection of economic and cultural forces, goods and travelers, commodities and commerce.
So what is pure commerce?
I think maybe to go on, because they'll kind of explain
clarify a bit.
The concept of the economy, as we now understand it, it had to be invented. And this required the stabilization of the unsettling and unsettled figure of the fair. As the bourgeoisie labored to produce the economic as a separate domain, partitioned off from its intimate and manifold interconnectedness with the festive calendar, so they labored conceptually to reform the fair as either a rational commercial trading event or as a popular pleasure ground. Such a division was necessary in order that the bourgeoisie could make a clean and definitive distinction between morally improving toil and decadent pleasure. The refusal of the temporal dismemberment of pleasure. Hence, although the bourgeois classes were frequently frightened by the threat of political subversion and moral license, they were perhaps more scandalized by the deep conceptual confusion, by the fierce mixing of work and pleasure, trade and play. The fear always carried traces of the specter of the work which could be free, threatening to rob commerce of the association with toil and capital accumulation that the bourgeoisie was trying to impose. That is why the carnival, the circus, the gypsy, the lumpen proletariat play a symbolic role in bourgeois culture, out of all proportion to their actual social importance. The carnival, the gypsy, and the lumpen proletariat all evoked forms of life and forms of commerce, which were incompatible with the solitary labor of the lonely bourgeoisie subject and the world it projected. That is why they could not be tolerated. If other forms of life were possible then, contrary to one of Mrs. Thatcher's most famous formulations, there were alternatives after all.
What is lumpen
So there is like workers, those, it comes from 19th century more or less, this term, I think, no? That there were these industry workers, but there were also those who would be, they would be taken in to the workplace when the economy would boom, but then they would be always thrown out when there would be crisis, and they were always on this kind of poverty.
And
because they were hired.
And they were... Yeah, but they were not really workers. They did
like vagrants.
Vagrants, or
so they would travel to find work.
And also not behave morally, and they didn't. They were considered not having self-discipline, unreliable, able to do small criminal acts, steal maybe, you know, drink,
gamble,
even now,
try
I think
to look
like
for opportunities. It's,
I
mean,
lots
it's
of
not people. Only being unemployed, that's not the same. And the concept is pretty rich and has a lot to say about the people who talk about it and when they have opinions. So I think
when they have opinion, yeah, but then it's pure, it's just more poor people than the most poor.
You got one.
You are
but,
a little,
yeah, but here.
Yes, well, for example, today it would be somebody who doesn't work legally or like just takes some jobs but then survives on this kind of, I don't know, from drinking to kind of, you know, this all these weak ways of surviving. And
but I think it's also marked as a culture, like a subjectivity. That's like,
yeah. That's what I
I'm
just, any questions about this?
For me, the first paragraph was
still empty.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to pack bit by bit or something.
No, it just seems like he's citing somebody, but I never read any of this marketplace since.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's this festive market, and I don't know. I mean, actually, I don't know much about this medieval marketplace, so it can be a bit confusing, but he's kind of comparing the festivity and passion and kind of messiness of trade in this festive market to the kind of sterile, purified kind of market relations we see today, which almost lack like a human factor, just something like this. And also there's this idea of the difference between like the separation of the economy.
I think the main point was separation, the market space, sort of to be market only for commercial stuff, and then to have a space that is only for leisure or whatever in your personal and entertainment.
Carnival.
Because basically the question could be how it differs from what we have today, because we do have fairs, we do have markets, and we do have carnivals, so you know, what's the key difference from what is being talked about?
Well, I think that it could be that these are, say, as you said, there's either the popular pleasure ground or the kind of rational, sterilized markets, and they're like kind of divided. So, like, we have these sanctioned spaces of excess, and then this rational spaces of calculated economic activity. What's in the medieval fair, it's like
I was just going to say, I think it's, firstly, I'm assuming it's from a British perspective, so I would say the fair is probably a place where there's a mixing of classes, right? Where you have, like, the bourgeois and then the, like, you know, petty bourgeois or the workers or whatever mixing in, and so you have this, like, I don't know, perhaps like a space that lacked the high morality of the petty bourgeois. That's what I assume. Like, historically, I'd say perhaps a comparison in the States is like the circus that, like, traveled around in the late or early 19th century or something like that. We have these circuses that, like, travel all around the States.
And so what's the connection with the circus? Like, so it's, like, similar or it's different?
Like, I would just say that like, cultural, like, incarnation in the States would be, like, the circus.
Mm-hmm. And here?
To be honest, I would to some extent disagree with this division because, yeah, we do have sort of more designated spaces for, you know, this is a supermarket, this is a fair, this is this and that. Like, the whole capitalist idea is that you get pleasure from consuming whatever you consume. So while you consume, you know, a burger, there is one kind of pleasure, but you still get music and you still get, you know, greeted nicely by people who are paid not enough. And if you're in a fair, it's slightly different, but I mean, maybe it works different in different contexts or in different period of time, but it's...
Let's take rave, for example, because you have this entrance that is for free. So, and you can, like, I don't know, somehow hustle in and, like, get NDMA for free maybe from some friends or something, and then you just, like, you know, you just continue no matter what your class or what your status
is.
You know, you have this kind of opportunity to get through it without consuming, kind of, in the, like, buying and selling stuff, so...
Well, I mean,
in a way.
But, you know, rave, like, different rave places, they're all also, like, being, like, they're not as idealistic and romantic, you know, like, there's, like, in Berlin or whatever, you know, like, this, you know, cities, and even here, you know, there's, like, places where, like, more, like, upper-class people go, you know, to party, and they're allowed only, like, if they belong to certain, like, class, you know, and then even if you hustle in, it's still, like, I don't know, maybe... It's interesting, yeah, it's interesting to think what happens when you, like, if you enter a place where you're not kind of supposed to be, like, you know,
to your class. The perfect example is in Brazil with favelas and the rich islands. If you enter a favela, you're not coming out alive, so...
You are if you come with a white people's organized favela rave tour. That's amazing.
You should be ashamed of it.
It was very, very bizarre to be a white person who paid a lot of money to be among local people who are just partying.
There's also, I mean, of course, like, the Burning Man was probably a really big landmark of, like, this festive collectivity concept, and also a good testament to its kind of limits, because, like, I think, well, most people know, but, like, yeah, you pay, like, a certain amount, it's, I think, quite a fair amount to get in, but once you're in, there's no commercial, like, monetary exchange. It's, like, all through barter and, like, gift economy or something. And, like, this is, like, right, but then, like, the other side is, like, Silicon Valley bros come and, like, have, like, their own, like, tents with, like, great cocaine, and hire, like, an army of escorts to, like, and it's, like, kind of, yeah, it's, like, there's, like, a difference, like, within the festivity of capitalism. It's kind of complicated to say. I just want to also bring the point that I think on the one hand, it's possible to really try to think what is this analogy of the fair, and I think I agree that it's probably you need to know a bit more of this British history and the cultural history of the thing to really know more what exactly was seen. But I think when they're talking about this bourgeois anxiety, maybe it's only part of the point. What is this purity and what is this mixing between the... I think in general the 17th, 18th, 19th century was the kind of time of the bourgeoisie trying to eliminate all these things that we are talking about, and the sort of uncoded, uncontrolled leisure or places which actually bring certain elements together which become a sort of breeding ground for unruly behavior. And I think this I've been reading from examples from France, from other countries and so on. This sort of unruliness that it brings, these spaces that really sort of, you know, this messiness of the place, it might have what we're talking today. If you go to this rave or whatever, if there is a coding, if there is entrance, if there is, you know, if someone is left behind, is it really friendly or whatever? All these things, I'm sure they play out also there, but I think all these spaces were eliminated, including in the UK. I don't know, cemeteries used to be a place where also sort of raves would happen. People would go and then be doing their stuff and playing out and having parties and so on. This had to be eliminated. Not that it really posed a threat to anyone, because in general you don't pose a threat to anyone being in the space of a cemetery, because you kind of don't affect anyone else except the dead people. But this also was a threat. So the threat is very much also, you know, of the threat of the potential of people can, you know, fuck shit up when they get together and they you know, mix things up. Right. And I think, like, it brings up another really strong example of the same period, which was, like, the prison. Because prisons today are built as penitentiaries. It's a model of, like, individual repentance and isolation. But the prisons of this time
there were just these big rooms, and people would like, it was this like very messy contagion. It was like not even gender like division, and like kind of it'd be these semi-autonomous spaces almost, where like political ideas would spread very rapidly, and they were like much less controlled and surveilled than what we see as prisons today in most parts of the world. Yeah,
because like introduction of life in the night, it entailed also like controlling of the night, basically. So that's also a lesson, like, this book of anarcho-capitalism. Which, this was quite interesting. Like, also, some of you have it as well. I would just kind of be, well, not reading, but kind of introducing it a bit. But it was like also in this book, the introduction of, you know, electric lighting is also... it was the introduction of electric lighting. It was attributed like also invention of a nightclub and the rave and the excesses in the night, which is basically then people also could come and, you know, extend their daily life basically into the night, which is a pretty interesting notion. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if people start living in the night, they also, like, police has to also, then you have to make controls of the night, so it doesn't become, like, too much to handle in that way.
So that's what the lights are for. Mm-hmm. Electric lights.
Yeah. And I talk too much, but just the last thing. I think the last little paragraph, actually, it really sums up what it's all about, despite all the details that he provides, that actually the certain forms of life, this was the threat, and this is something that couldn't be tolerated. So I think anything, any practice or any kind of subject position, that was really something not pure outside, not pure something, but something that mixes, but something that has its own kind of style, and that it's not comparable with this thing that for centuries, this new kind of capitalist economy required of this individual that goes to work as a wage laborer or whatever, that, you know, the new economy requires. All these were threat, and they are kind of threat to this day, but in different kinds of formations and so on.
So, ask it.
Sure. Mandatory individualism. Capitalist modernity was thus shaped by the always incomplete process of eliminating festive collectivity. It is possible, says the Foucault of Discipline and Punished, to read the impress of such collectivity in the very form that disciplinary institutions such as factory, the school, and the hospital would assume. Behind the disciplinary mechanisms can be read the haunting memory of contagious, of the plague, of rebellions, crimes, vagabondage? How do you pronounce that?
Vagabondage?
Desertions, people who appear to disappear, life, live and die in disorder. In this memory, which is also a fiction, a hyperstition, plague and festivity fuse. Both are imagined as spaces where the boundaries between bodies collapse, where faces and identities slip. A whole literary fiction of the festival grew up around the plague. Suspended laws, lifted prohibitions, the frenzy of passing time, bodies mingling together without respect, individuals unmasked, abandoning their statutory identity and the figure under which they had been recognized, allowing quite a different truth to appear. The solutions in an imposed individualism, the inverse of carnival, not the collective festival, but strict divisions, not laws transgressed, but the penetration of regulation to the into even the smallest details of everyday life, through the medium of the complete hierarchy that assured the capillary functioning of power. Not masks that were put on and taken off, but the assignment of each individual of his true name, his true place, his true body, his true disease. So relevant.
Yeah. But why? No, sorry. But like, why? Like, the fiction is around the plague, but the like laws are suspended, prohibitions lifted, or something. Shouldn't be in verse. Or am I missing the point?
But I think isn't the whole idea sort of suspension of normality,
mm-hmm.
so that anything gets a chance to sneak through.
Mm-hmm.
It's not corona.
Another case.
Well, the it's this the fiction I think is the how the plague and the contagion of the festival are collapsed in the mind of the bourgeoisie, like the threat of plague
mm-hmm.
and the threat of the festive collectivity become one and the same thing. Both kind of one is a social disease of. A kind of culture that's resistant to the emergence of capitalist order, and the other is like a virus that's spreads through, you know. And so in the bourgeois mind, the two are collapsed, the flag and the fuss.
Like the mob.
Yeah, the fear of the mob, yeah, mm-hmm. I think. The fear of the suspension of law, just as now we have a huge... Like the paranoia of corona merges with the paranoia of social unrest, like just in Greece, and it's like many countries, but they passed new laws that like restrict the ability to assemble. And during the COVID period, they like evicted two of the major squats in the city under because. There is this merging, the fear of the mob, the fear of like social independence of people, and the plague, and the kind of intertwining fantasies
of
lack of
social. So the virus kind of makes the law even stronger, and the control of all the society and the boundaries become like very. Very visible.
Well, it becomes a state of exception.
But I think that it's more that I think you like takes on this kind of how the law appears is that it always has this history when it reacted to something kind of extraordinary and being like kind of almost I think like every law was at first like a
exception
and then it's just naturalizes itself. And
Hold on. Maybe someone wants to read
it. I can.
Okay.
The capitalist realism that took hold in the UK in the 90s and aimed to complete this project of mandatory individualism.
Okay.
Very
excited.
Yeah. Any remaining traces of collectivity were now being extirpated. Such traces were to be found not only in raves, in traveler encampments and free parties, but also on the football terraces and in football fan culture, elements of which were in any case fusing the break. The 1989 Hillsborough disaster was English football's equivalent of a shock doctrine analyzed by Naomi Klein. The disaster, caused by the malicious incompetence of Thatcher's police, the nocturous West Yorkshire force, allowed an aggressive corporate takeover of English football. Terraces were closed down, and from now on each spectator was assigned an individual seat. At a stroke, a whole form of collective life was shut down. Modernization of English football stadia was long overdue, but this was a neoliberal version of modernization, which I quoted it with hyper-commodification, individualism, and corporatization. The crowd was decomposed into solitary consumers, and the rebranding of the top tier of English football as the Premiership and the selling of the television rights to Sky were the harbingers of the high-top existential desolation of life in 21st century England. The lonely connectedness of smartphone addiction is a depressive tonic reversal of MDMA festivity. Sociality is supervised by multiple embedded corporate platforms. We become our faces, working 24/7 for communicative capitalism.
So sad.
But anyone knows about Hillsborough disaster?
I think it was the biggest, there was a football match and there was stomping or something happened and I don't know, ended something like, while everyone was trying to escape the stadium.
It's like Love Parade. Mm-hmm. When, like, basically they had to go way back because they didn't contain the excessive amounts of people and there was just passing. Some patio, I don't know. Mm. And then people were actually died because of so many people were at this rave. So they had to kind of, down to just looking it up.
Yeah, I stick on this passage. The lonely connectedness of smartphone addiction is a depressive hedonic reversal of MDMA festivity.
I also have it underlined.
So, do you want to comment on it? Because
yeah,
for me, it just sounds like a very poetic expression of a fairly unimpressive point.
No, I think you should understand that he's like this kind of cultural critique, and it goes, I think, between poetry and.
Well, he has this idea.
I understand that.
He has this idea in capitalist realism. I don't know if members of this depressed, like, hedonism. I forget what it's called. But anyways, a depressive hedonic reversal. So, like a lonely connectedness, smartphone addiction. It's also a kind of hedonism, but it's like a MDMA collectivity is depressive individualized reversal. So instead of like a collective outward hedonism of like a raves, MDMA collectivity, smartphone addiction becomes like this interiorization of affects, of feelings, because it's like, it brings people out of their environment into this digitized emotional landscape.
Yeah. So kind of replaces.
Opposite somehow. I mean, that's like lonely connectedness, which you're alone. Like this is your like hedonism, but like the MDMA is the collective festivity, as I understand.
I think he has it also in this capitalist realism book that something about that. Okay, in modernity, whatever it was that. You could escape through pleasure to some kind of freedom, but then in neoliberalism, it becomes that the only option for you is this kind of pleasure or entertainment, and there is nothing else. So you kind of become this depressive, hedonistic life that you have only some kind of form of, like, I don't know.
Right, not boredom, but kind of pressing over saturation on stimulation.
Yeah, something like constant stimulation that becomes depressive in its own way of being. This kind of compulsive pseudo excitement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just like a dopamine hit, right? That you get from it, like a gamified app, like Instagram, Facebook, or WhatsApp, or whatever. And it becomes not WhatsApp, but these are like gamified apps. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's designed for you to use it, and they're very good at designing it such that you get random feedback from the app, which hits the dopamine, which gives you pleasure, so you keep scrolling.
So it's basically you can have every day.
Sure, yeah, but I also think his take on it is kind of a bit like, it's like someone complaining about like the television or something, broadcast television, or whatever. It's like being normalized now. So.
Sure. But when someone wants to be all this, oh, this is just old people's talk about this, but most those of people also do complain about their parents or grandparents watching television. So I think, you know, who's going to complain about what in a few years? But now all this being very progressive and this all kind of taking it in and saying, don't be so conservative and Adornian and things and
don't be so negative.
It's interesting, like, it's very vivid points on football stadiums, and, like, the actual architectural redesign, like, organization of, like, basically an anti-social infrastructures in cities. And, I'm sure, like, I think we could name many, many different instances of these types of like individualizing and anti-social public spaces. Universities, say, were also reorganized to be a kind of occupation resistant. There was, I think actually you introduced this point some years ago or something. But there was this nice research done on how the modern universities' layouts have been built to kind of prevent the kind of assembly, mass assemblies of people in ways that would be hard to police. Also, the most famous instance is the boulevards in France. So after the revolutions, the kind of founder of modern urban planning redesigned the boulevards into these really wide streets so that people would have a hard time creating blockades and there couldn't be as easily urban uprisings. So it's like
and that military can move easily for the streets.
Right.
Is that why people as Magnus University don't have a canteen?
Well, I think you're onto something.
Just a local example.
No, and I think Acropolis is a very iconic place because it's this kind of privatization of public space, but then this kind of total takeover of it because you have it like all is super nice, but then it has all these security cameras, so all this, like, what, lumpen proletariat couldn't enter, like, those who cannot, don't have money to consume, they're thrown out of this place because it's a kind of...
So. Yeah, but you can always trick them.
That's the point of it, yeah.
I mean, I read a lot of texts about, like, researches, how this... Mallers, supermarkets become a public space in sort of a way that people just use it as their hanging out space.
Yeah.
So a lot of transforming.
But, yeah, but like the intention is there. But,
And you can easily hide. Them.
Yeah, and, yeah. Hide between them.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that.
No voice.
Okay. The move to The move to mandatory individualization was not, of course, immediately successful. The Criminal Justice Act provoked new forms of carnivalesque rebellion, most notably reclaimed the streets. If the images of motorways blocked by rivers now seem to belong to a long ago historical era that is tantalizingly distant, as impossibly far off in some ways as the countercultural 60s, then the waves of new political organization that have passed through Greece, Spain, Scotland, and now, with the Jeremy Corbyn surge, even England reminds us that the project of mandatory individualism can never be completed. At any point, collectivity can be rediscovered, reinvented. The specter of a world that can be free has always to be stifled. It could flare up in any festivity that goes on too long, in any of workplaces or university occupation that refuses the necessity of drudgery, in any flourishing of a group consciousness that rejects the inevitability of competitive individualism. The sheer extent and intensity of the machinery that was necessary to shut down rave is a testament to this. Individualism has had to be enforced, surveilled, compelled. All of capital's now flailing and conspicuously exhausted inventiveness is dedicated to this compulsion. What does it mean, like, machinery to shut down rave?
Policing,
the amount of police, like, is it lost.
Is it like literal machinery? Okay.
Political machinery, more like.
Yeah, that's
criminal justice, the police, the politicians, the media that was saying all these bad things happened there and so on.
Yeah. Just reclaim the streets.
Ah, yeah.
What?
You familiar?
Not really.
So this started in the mid-90s or earlier in the UK. And there was this thing shutting down the city in London, and part of it was these carnivals where they brought something else to the streets. So it wasn't a typical political demonstration, but all these people on these, what do you call these, long sticks, having kind of sound systems, doing lots of these triangles, sort of stuff that was later used in all these protests and occupations of, let's say, the environmental protests and so on. So it was a kind of bringing rave on the street but having a political message, and it was something very new in the context. And actually this thing very much led also in popularizing it in terms of all these protests that started in the late 90s that went into all this, what it became known as the anti-globalist movement and so on. So parts of these elements, and I think these scenes very much intervene, the squatters, the environmentalists, so all the different kinds of political groupings, but also bringing so-called not-so-political ravers, those who were doing these tree parties and doing stuff in the nature, bringing back into the city and doing stuff together.
I mean, there's quite some examples now, especially in Berlin, where like the ravers or like the clubs kind of try to get also on the streets and to protest or to like to be political, basically. Of course, there's many examples of that, but I'm just kind of remembering this kind of one of bad examples that we discussed in one of our meetings about how the recent demonstration, which was like floating in a river and having a rave, like was like demonstration to open up the clubs again and also like take care of the, you know, like of the ravers, but also of the club workers and of the clubs. And there was like very tone deaf of like when the Black Lives Matter protests were happening, and it was, they were completely out of touch basically from the other political realities, basically, in today. I'm just thinking about, like, you know, when it's the political, when the rape itself can be like is treated as political. Maybe I'm getting to that direction more, you know.
But I think that's maybe would be a nice thing to open up as a kind of closing discussion in a way. So maybe we can finish the last paragraph and then kind of...
Can I?
Yeah.
Okay. You're crazy. From time to time, writes Frederick Jameson, in Balances of the Dialectic, like a diseased eyeball in which disturbing flashes of light are perceived, or like those baroque sunbursts in which rays of from another world suddenly break into this one, we are reminded that utopia exists and that other systems, other spaces are still possible. This psychedelic imagery seems especially apposite for the energy flash of rave, which now seems like a memory bleeding through from a mind that is not ours. In fact, the memories come from ourselves as we once were, a group consciousness that waits in the virtual future, not only in the actual past. So it is perhaps better to see the other possibilities that these baroque slumbers illuminate, not as some distant utopia, but as a carnival that is achingly proximate, a specter haunting even, especially the most miserably desocialized spaces.
I'm wondering if the rape that he has in mind is somehow different and if some kind of true rape happened in the 80s and now. Because, yeah, now I have seen all this underground rape space, Lisbeth and Kona, so I think this might be
awesome. But I think you need to. Sorry, but I would insist that sometimes, you know, language matters. And I think the way you would call certain things, and if there is just some kind of resemblance, and then you will insist that this is it, and actually not make maybe sometimes much clearer division, that also helps reproduce maybe this kind of resignation, sense of resignation and lack of possibility of imagining or of acting, you know, or creating spaces. So,
sure. And one of, I guess, the interesting things can be, like, in the, well, given that, like, say, if the raves were had their peak moments and that moment was cut short or repressed by this political machinery, the kind of post-rave is the club. And the club is, again, like an enclosure. And I guess there's also very different periods of the club that should be distinguished. So what is the club post-rave in the UK? Like environments and like, how does that change the culture and politics of nightlife? I don't know these questions in detail, especially in the UK, but yeah. But going back to this question of like political raves and not like, yeah, now we see like the rave is really thrown around a lot, like the concepts. So, well, I think like the most infamous example as of late in Lithuania was Platforma's day rave, and which was branded as like a protest rave, and all of the clubs in Vilnius, I think almost all of them sent people to DJ at this rave. Of course, like, yeah, it's problematic in the sense that, as some know, maybe some don't, like, the people running Platforma were actively collaborating with this, the municipality to rebrand that piece of land because they had developers that wanted to move in and build like a very large office complex but were hesitant because the neighborhood has a bad reputation. So, you know, we have like it's not such a simple thing, like nightlife culture as a resistant thing. We have to be somehow clear when it at certain points in what we are going to invest our energy in terms of like thinking politically, just as I think the case very strongly went with Berlin, which was
because you know it's like not everything is a rave and not every rave is like something magical and you know insurgent or something, which is I think it's a very interesting line to think about when, you know, especially when we're doing the Ultimate Leisure Workers Club, you know, it's like we have to kind of think about things, basically.
And just also if thinking about these sort of, I don't know, conceptual or practical divisions, one thing maybe kind of what you're saying is that it can be a very commercial place, could be used for even the intended purpose or not intended, and have something very much, you know, something very energetic, very exciting, something very much out of this world, and to be a true escape, no? Mm-hmm. And they can be a rave and do these things or not. But I think my sense is that, you know, certainly in many places in Europe, but I would think around the world, there is still very much the sort of old, hardcore, idealistic notion of rave should be, which would have few very simple rules that you not breach. And this is, you kind of qualify for what the rave is. That it's illegal, and that it's free, and that it's kind of, you know, somewhat secret, but not secret for the purpose of being selective or exclusive, but for the purpose of securing everyone's security against authority. And for me, kind of these three things is what qualifies as rave. Mm-hmm. And I think most, the kind of vernacular today about what rave is usually doesn't have most or none of these elements. Sure. And I think, you know, and it's a good discussion, could be maybe in the future, you know, whether it's something to strive for, what are the kind of cons and pros of this and so on, and also how it brings back the notions of, let's say, communism, and how it brings notions of anti-capitalism or anti-state and all these kinds of things and so on. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it is seen now, but you know, now we cannot do these things because back in the day, many of the, let's say, these ravers were living in squats, so they didn't have money and they could steal maybe sound system, that's why they could do it and so on and so on. But sometimes I think it's not only the point of resources, but it's really something about the sort of our contemporaneity or something, you know, how we see things and what kinds of things we desire and why and so on. So I think it's, you know, broader question, but I think an important one.
Mm-hmm. Like, do you propose to, like, reclaim the rave from those who have claimed it in a bad manner? And,
I don't know, I think, you know, I think this sort of rave in its old school variety, I think it has an appeal. And I think this is actually how you can sort of, one of the ways how you can immediately, by its own setting, sort of a little bit politicize your existence and politicize your leisure, because you kind of have this feeling of that there is, you know, something a little bit in excess or against something, or, you know, there is an immediately relationship to symbolic order by doing something like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's like, this goes with this question of, you know, post-club and, like, post-clubbing, which we would know, and, like, we'll be bringing up later on, that it's kind of, I'm quite wary of, like, going back to this perfect 90s, because I don't think it was everything so perfect, and on all the raves and, like, and all the, like, acid techno and all of that. It has its own virtues and not. But, like, it's interesting to think in terms of post-club clubbing, which is, again, it's, like, extremely politicized raving or going to a club, which is, but also it's like on very aesthetic notion, which I think it's really interesting. And in Berlin is basically, I think it's in a, it's reviving its, like, lost 90s, which is a city which has lost really that thing. I think it's like, a new way of even imagining oneself in like this kind of soundscape, let's say, which is also has a strong political message, and like this post-clubbing, what it would be, it's like even the whole music and like music that people create and places they go to, people they hang out with, and to the, you know, it's like very communal in a sense, or like how, even how to look like, this is all like kind of has the message of like anti-capitalism and all of this, which is, it's quite interesting. So like, I'm just, what I'm seeing is just maybe trying to see what other forms are possible that could, like, we take the virtues, let's say, of the things that we find could be nice to bring back.
What, could you give some more specific examples, mm-hmm, of, like, why a post-club, like, how it kind of broke from
club and like has some political messages or something.
I mean, okay, it's very very like simple example, but basically, you know, like again, like Berlin example, but it's very cheesy, but still, you know, it's, some things happen there. It's just like, for example, it's acknowledging that much of the nightclub, like nightlife scene in Berlin, which used to be like very political, you know, happened in all these kind of industrial spaces and all of that. But now we have like clubs that were born out of 90s or like later on, like Berghain, which is, you know, it's Mecca, the stupid Mecca of like all the people who don't know what to do with themselves and how to party. And it's kind of, now it's like pretty much like it's very exclusive, this kind of very elitist place to go to rave, and it's like, has been is so like it's basically like, you know, capitalist dream there, and like very specific people, like very, you know, like it's very class based raving basically to go there. So like in response to that, people are choosing to go to like smaller clubs or like clubs who are openly political, like who kind of yeah, who participate in a political scene, and then you kind of go to support them, and there's like a lot of there's like even the music, let's say, that comes out of it, like as I said, with like music that comes in mind with this like anti-capitalist ideals, it's like it's kind of this music that is not really danceable, basically. I mean, the breaking up, you know, of the dance floor, which is like this repetitive beats, you go all night, you know, like, and you take some pills, and then like it's for hours the same beat happens. So even that is kind of being idealized, and like it's not even possible too much to dance to that music. Mm. But you gather there because of the different, like, of the access, you know, of other thing that is not necessarily what drawn people in the 90s. So even, yeah, so it's like maybe against the, you know, sound of machinery.
But isn't it elitistic on the other hand? Like, because it becomes like very, like, less acceptable for a lot of people to kind of enjoy, you know, the night and the leisure. And it's kind of, well, I don't know, I'm not much familiar with the concept, but I think what I know about it, it just feels to me kind of building up another form of, like, pretty elitistic, you know, kind of, at least it seems like that. I don't know. If it comes from a different point, I don't know, maybe there's something doing wrong with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's always, like, the danger of this is, like, in many things, no? Like, when it's, very specific idea or like outlook, and then you kind of try to detach yourself from the main, you know, you then become the new elitist.
But I've been to this kind of places in Berlin, and it was about refugee crisis and about this gathering, like the money we're collecting for them, and it was the music was really danceable.
No, it's like I'm going like more from like aesthetic.
But my idea is more about like aesthetic side of it, because it has like a different kind of movement. Like it's not all about parties being political.
But
it's kind of deconstruction of the club music.
It seems like it's a bit of like artistic niche term or something. It's like not about like establishing a different kind of political club culture, but about creating a kind of artistic genre. It's like not a niche term, but it's like a genre, not like a. I think that's probably why, for me as well, and we've been talking for some time, why I still don't understand like what it is, because I think I've always thought of it, okay, post club must be some kind of thing that like reacts to like club culture and then like creates like a new political space. But I think when you're referring to post club, you're referring to like a music genre in a way that carries with it the culture, but it's not like just like the literal meaning of post club, but like
it's music, but you know, it goes from music, you know, and it goes from like this new aesthetics in a way, but also it's like a space which is like, but it does tries to create a space which is extremely like inclusive, which is extremely expression friendly. I mean, and this is also very Very interesting. Well, you know, and it is very different from what you get in some other, like, more popular Berlin clubs, you know, like, it's all, like, I don't know.
But actually, one reference point, and I just say it because I knew it personally, is you sent me this meme of, like, what host club was, and it's, like, listed this one party in New York called Ghetto Goth, and this is one of the only parties I went to, not because, like, I was very selective about the parties I went to, just because, for whatever reason, I showed up at this one, and it started, I think, in 2010 or 9 or something. And, like, basically, it was, like, kind of more, like, there was, like, kind of led by, like, black, trans DJs. It was mashing up, like, kind of techno with, like, some kind of Al Jazeera headline with, like, some kind of rap or something. And it was in, like this small basement or something. Mm-hmm. And then it became very big over time. But, yeah, so...
But this case would be close towards that.
Right. Okay, yeah. So, yeah. But I don't think they would call themselves post club.
No. Like, this is also this very, like, term that no one likes in the post club. Like, also, like, deconstructed club music is also no one wants to use that. But it's again, like,
conceptronica.
Always something that's horrible. But but it is like a name which, like, someone coined. Yeah, but again, you know, we kind of try to evade these labels. Yeah. But, like, yeah, but I do find this kind of interesting in you know, in a way, because I do think it's interesting to kind of move away from, like, or try to to move away from this kind of tropes that we're so, like, familiar with all the time. 90s, I mean, oh my god, rave, oh my god, you know, acid techno, oh my god, you know, the Detroit, you know, which is all fine, but it's just, I think it's a nice envision something.
But I think one point that's really strong about, like, your kind of, your position is, like, what we've been seeing a bit in this contemporary kind of political club scene is, like, really, like, putting a lot more presence on, like, histories and also current, like, scenes of, like, black techno. And, like, we can say that, like, yeah, generally, like, techno has been really whitewashed, and it's been, like, a really big problem, which also really hits, like, the rave scene pretty hard in a lot of places.
And Berlin is also, that's why it was, like, because Berlin is really whitewashed, and all these, like, popular clubs are really white, and conservative,
actually. So, like, that's, like...
That's business.
So, like, this platforms, like, Discakes, and also Daily Bread and others, they're really fronting, like, black and queer, and, like, other, like, undocumented and, like, connected with, like, political groups, and it's, like, more of a, let's say, conscious club culture. I didn't go, neither of us went to these parties, so that's, like, verify everything. I'm sure there's contradictions, but it's something maybe interesting to look at.
There are some, I mean, there are not only these kind of forms of, like, raves, but also we have, like, raves in Georgia, for example.
Yeah,
like,
the Poland
culture that is, like, totally, like, against this, like, anti-authoritarian and, like, all this.
So, it would be really interesting to see here, like, more parties, more collectives that are, like, organizing a bit more under, like, directly political banners and, like, want to show solidarity with movements and this kind of thing.
I don't know, but I always have this feeling about such texts, but that, I mean, I know he's pretty subtle about what he says, this, like, Fischer, but I still have this feeling that, you know, there is this capital control, and on the other hand, you have this, like, unconscious revolutionary partying, raving thing going on, and I think it's not, like, I sometimes feel like it's pretty much under context where it happens, and it really doesn't need to have all the time this, that partying is always somehow out of capitalism. I think
now it's like in our times it's like kind of this capitalist culture, like this, you know, platform is always creating this feeling that is somehow exceptional and not like some kind of Gita slash Kavitas concertus, but some kind of, you know, special thing. And then at the same point, it would be very commercial and very common. So it's,
I mean,
and I think this text doesn't resolve this kind of contradiction that in '80s the rape was pretty legal and so on, but now you have rapes which are super legal and like, and then.
I mean, the whole construct of weekend is very capitalist, you know, because it's like we have time separated. We go work and, you know, and do that, and time we go where we relax, and our relaxation entails, you know, raving. So, like, it cannot be just black and white in this sense, basically, because we have designated, times for that. But then, you know, like, so, but on the other hand, then, you know, like, it's interesting to think about these raves that do spill out of, like, the normal working or sleeping hours, you know, like in like these raves, like like that start on Sunday and end on Monday, you know, and then no one goes to work.
But still they happen like in London, Berlin, like
Well, yes.
I wouldn't imagine something going on.
But we can try. That's the thing.
Last week about, we started Sunday at 9 and ended at 12 or whatever, but somebody did the after party, so I'm sure it not everyone went to school and work on Monday, so, you know, pretty guaranteed.
Well, yeah, but these are, like, interesting forms to play with, you know, like, I think that's where, like, thinking about nightlife and, like, raves are, like, it's very accessible in a way, you know, like, in kind of think about the politics of every day.
And then another thing is also space, and I'm still, actually, in the end, I'm very uncomfortable about, you know, the kind of, the clubs and raves and post-clubs and nightlife and so on. I think, not that they need to be all clearly defined, but I think, actually, what we're talking about is such a spectrum of things, and I think it's also not about just some things that happened in the past, you know, 30 years ago, whatever, because things happen. And I would qualify this rape that happened by the bridge, whatever, you know, by the river here, like, some years ago. I mean, for me, it was the perfect rape, even if it was kind of in the center of the city, and it wasn't, you know, very secretive or whatever, and the cops came and this and that, you know, and it didn't last for days and days, but there was definitely something, Adomas and so on, and many people here could tell of many other occasions and so on. But I think things do happen, but, you know, then once again, and, you know, it's a bit sad that we're talking always about these references from Berlin or London or whatever.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Because I think we can also talk, and even not in such spectacular maybe forms, but of things also happening here now, or in the past, or, you know, in the near future.
But it's an interesting point in a way that, you know, maybe...